I want to remind all amateur storytellers that Current State has room for more of you at our pop-up stories event. Our storytelling event is our second pop-up stories storytelling event. It's set for Sunday afternoon at the East Lansing Public Library, 2 until 3:30 p.m. The theme you should be ruminating on, loan and borrow. Ever loan something you wish you hadn't, or borrowed something and kind of forgot to return it? You get the theme. Amateur storytellers can connect with us. Let us know if you'd like to share a story along those lines this Sunday afternoon, East Lansing Public Library. Check us out on Facebook at Current State from WKAR to learn more. You can also tweet us with your interest at KAR Current State on Twitter. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome to a Thursday edition of Current State. This is Mental Health Awareness Week in America, and in Michigan, advocates want you to be aware of what they say is a looming mental health problem. Service providers say more than 300 people in mid-Michigan who receive mental health care through Medicare will soon lose some of those services. They say that's partly due to cuts in state general fund dollars that were made with the expectation that Medicaid expansion funding would fill the gaps. Meanwhile, the Lansing chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is hosting a national expert on mental health crisis intervention. Sam Cochran is a retired Memphis police officer. He helped create a national model used by law enforcement agencies to intervene with mentally ill persons. I spoke with Mr. Cochran just after his arrival in Lansing yesterday. He told me the program was created back in 1987 following a confrontation between the Memphis police and a young man suffering from mental illness.
26-year-old individual was cutting himself with a knife. After a brief encounter, he was shot multiple times by our officers, which really stirred up a community unrest.
Did he die?
Yes.
Okay.
And it became, in many ways, political. Our mayor at that particular time formed a community task force. The mission of that task force is come up with a plan to provide safety for the officers, safety for the family members, and safety for people who live and struggle with mental illness, which was brilliant. Everybody's for that.
Let's go a little bit deeper into the CIT model exactly, the Crisis Intervention Team model. How does it work?
It is about a first responder. We have officers that are CIT officers. They're embedded into what we refer to as the uniform patrol. They're first responders. So when a crisis call comes through 911, that dispatcher that is assigning calls to a particular officer has a list of all of the available CIT officers on that particular shift. It's a 24-hour service. So we have officers that work different shifts that everyone's familiar with. So when that dispatcher assigns a CIT officer to that call event, she or he will also assign other officers to be support. But it's very critical to understand that CIT officer is the specialist. That's the person that's going to be directing the outcome of this crisis event. We're looking for that specialist role of an officer we call CIT.
It's National Mental Health Awareness Week. We are talking today with Major Sam Cochran. Mr. Cochran's a retired police officer who spent 33 years on the Memphis Police Department, and today he is a nationally sought consultant and expert in mental illness crisis intervention. He's in Lansing discussing the Crisis Intervention Team approach with NAMI Lansing. What have we learned through sometimes painful trial and error about how to approach incidents with mentally ill people?
From a law enforcement perspective, we've learned some very unique skills that end result. Remember, at the very beginning of this was all about safety. It was all about safety for everyone. But we had to learn some uniqueness about some of the training and some of the skills in order to ensure safety was the final outcome. And one of the things that we had to address, oftentimes family members, NAMI, will point out stigma towards that of mental illness. And this is not a reflection of law enforcement. The real question is, Is there stigma within the community? And I think if you look real closely, yes, there is stigma within our communities of where we live with regards to mental illness. Oftentimes, portraying people who live and struggle with mental illness is always violent, always dangerous, and always out to do harm. And that's just not true. So it's important that the officers, not only with great training, but they have an understanding of mental illness being a brain illness and addressing that as if you would address any other type of physical injury, such as heart patients or diabetics and things of that nature.
So the crisis intervention team member who might go out on a particular call, do the other officers involved in that incident defer to that CIT team member in certain ways?
It is understood that on a crisis event that the CIT officer, remember now, these officers know each other. They work together. But it is understood that the CIT officer is the lead officer. That brings clarity to a crisis event. And if you need clarity, it is at a crisis event.
And I would take it that a good crisis intervention team member is good at verbal de-escalation. I know one of the things that you're doing in Lansing this week is helping instruct verbal de-escalation techniques. Can you give us an example of that?
Well, there's many layers within that, and we don't have time to do all the different layers, but I'm going to be focusing on presenting as a coach, and I'm going to introduce a playbook. And this playbook has to do with some verbal de-escalation skills that actually are part of strategy. These skills really have a purpose in mind, and that's to open up communications. Remember, that is at the front line of what we're trying to do. We're trying to connect with an individual that may be struggling significantly with some of the symptoms relating to mental illness, and we need to slow things down. We need to open up communications, and we need to address some real critical issues that are at a crisis that oftentimes we fail to address, and that's fear. And that's anger, and that's hopelessness. And so that officer understands that addressing those three levels is part of strategy, part of opening up communication, and part of reaching a safe conclusion.
And are active listening skills at the heart of that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Active listening skills are unique. And again, many of our officers are doing that. They just don't know they're doing it. And we're going to, we're not only going to be enhancing those active listening skills, but we're going to be reassuring them, hey, you're doing a good job. A lot of times our officers don't have confidence because many times we'll talk to officers and they're interacting with people in crisis and they say, I don't know that I'm getting through. I don't know that I'm doing right. Actually, they really are. They're doing good, but so they don't have confidence. So a lot of being a CIT officer is also about establishing confidence.
Again, we're talking with Major Sam Cochran, a retired Memphis police officer who spent 33 years on the force there. He's today, and he has been, a nationally sought-after consultant and expert in mental illness crisis intervention, and he's in Lansing today talking about his crisis intervention team approach. I promised we'd talk about the importance of community partnerships here. Talk to us about who you need to connect with to make this work.
All right. There's multiple partnerships, but the three primary partnerships that have got to be at the very beginning and have to be continually nurturing this this effort, and that's law enforcement. Obviously, that goes without saying. Mental health providers. We have to have those mental health providers within the community and the advocacy. Now, probably at the thrust of the advocacy partnership is that of NAMI. You have Mental Health of America that their place, but clearly across the United States, NAMI has set the stage. And the reason I say that, in 1986, our local NAMI in Memphis was saying, your officers are not trained, your officers are not trained. That message was heard, but it was not acted upon. And then in 1987, we had the shooting event. And then in 1988, when we had the mission to implement a program that would provide safety, NAMI was brought to the table. So out of that task force effort, NAMI had a voice, and they continue to have a voice. They take ownership of the program, And we want all of the partners to take ownership. Ownership is very critical. But in order to take ownership, you have to have an identity. You can't own anything you can't identify. And so we want that identity. We want the law enforcement to say, CIT, oh, that's our program. That's our program. We want the mental health people to say, CIT, oh, we do all of the training. That's our program. And we want advocacy to say, CIT, that's our program. That's our program.
Mental health funding is a very big issue in this state. I imagine you see this play out in other areas of the country. How important is it to invest more dollars in mental health funding?
Funding is important. Funding relates to services. So legislators or council people or city commissioners, whoever, they have a responsibility to be good stewards of tax funding. So it's important that what the funding that is going is actually addressing some of the community issues, and they need to be listening to the community with regards to what those issues are. CIT is just one platform, a platform by which to address what those community issues are. And quite frankly, if you look at across the United States and what we're going, we're having a lot of similar issues where funding, you're hearing that story over and over again. It's challenging. Rural areas oftentimes will have a sense of hopelessness. We can't do CIT. We have no funding. I say, no, you have to do CIT simply because you don't have funding, because that mission is supposed to push forward that awareness to those funding resources in order to create additional services. And so it really becomes a community demand. When you get the community united together, when you have law enforcement standing with mental health providers, and you have mental health providers and law enforcement standing with NAMI, that's a pretty powerful voice for a mayor to say, I'm sorry, we're cutting back. Why don't we come together as a community? We come together because this is where we want to raise our family. This is where we want to have jobs and homes and go to churches and do all the things. What are we doing with regards to people that we see on the streets of our communities? You know, if you were to see a citizen carrying a white cane with a red tip trying to cross the street, ain't no doubt in my mind, you'd have a traffic jam in Lansing, Michigan, of people getting out of their cars, helping that individual cross the street. How many people are in our parks or on the side of the road that are languishing in pain and struggling and hardship relating to a brain illness? And yet we distort that medical understanding to say it's all about behavior. That person doesn't want help, or that person won't comply with help. I think that's just a challenge for us to act as a community and do the right thing.
Local mental health officials in this area would like to see a crisis intervention team established here in Ingham County. Right now, only two counties in Michigan have such a program, Kalamazoo County and St. Joseph County. What does it take to establish a CIT?
It takes people coming to the table and not being afraid. And what I mean by that is, let's just take, for example, the mental health providers. If you do CIT right, you will have an increase of individuals coming to your attention. Now, if you're a mental health director and you're saying, wait a minute, you're going to tell me I'm going to have more people coming into my services, and yet you're cutting my funding, that's pretty challenging. That's pretty frightening. The mental health directors, they have responsibility of their employees. You have a lot of great case managers, I would suspect. All of a sudden, you double the patient load with regards to case managers. How can that case manager be able to serve a population that's all of a sudden being doubled simply because we can't add more case managers? And it takes those individuals to come together and saying, this is our community. Our community needs us. So I need champions. So keep it focused. We want our community. We want our effort of CIT to be better than yesterday.
Our guest today has been Sam Cochran. He's a retired major with the Memphis Police Department, and he's an expert in mental health crisis intervention, and he's helped many law enforcement agencies in the U.S. develop these programs. Mr. Cochran, thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it, and I appreciate you putting up with my accent.
Thank you. Thank you.
Photography enthusiasts know sepia as a dark brown tint often used in historical pictures. Sepia to Selfies is a photography exhibit now on view at the Michigan Historical Center's Library of Michigan. Hundreds of photographs trace the history of Lansing from the early days of photography to the present. The exhibit is curated by Lansing journalist Bill Castanier. WKAR's Peter Worf caught up with Bill at the Library of Michigan earlier this week to tour the exhibit. Bill Castanier started the conversation in the aerial photography section, which highlights Michigan native Ted Abrams.
And what made him unique is he designed and patented an airplane that was special, and it's a very bizarre looking airplane. There's a video game that airplane is in that somebody's picked up.
We're trying
to find out. Somebody mentioned it to us that was through here, and they said there's a video game that plane's in.
Right.
Because it's hard to explain. It's the whole front of it's glass.
Right.
Looks cut off.
It's got the twin boom in the back, sort of cigar shaped, but
right.
It's almost like a greenhouse in the front. There's so much glass.
It's kind of a buggish looking thing.
It is.
But he also invented the cameras that took aerial photography, and he started shooting aerial photography of the kind we see here, which is very detailed, in the 20s. And he became world famous. His business was here in Lansing. It was Abrams Aerial Corporation. One of the things that we also have, although it's not a photograph, it's a piece of the actual plane. It's the piece that's right after, or right before the door, and it's manufactured by Abrams Aircraft Corporation. It's a steel sheet of the plane. One of the things, if we walk over here,
Yeah. There's
some more examples of Abrams aerial photography that shows...
Here he is applying it to 496.
I-496 before and after. And you can see the hundreds and hundreds of homes and businesses in a 1948 aerial photograph. And then, it was kind of compared to a 1970 photograph where that stretch looks like it was cut with a lawnmower. They're gone. This is right before the I-496 opened in December of 1970. And I think more and more these kind of photographs are being discovered as of historical importance. I mean, they're interesting. I mean, you can look at this and analyze exactly what happened.
Here's the neighborhood, street by street, house by house, really tree by tree, as it no longer exists. I imagine that this would have been helpful to people planning the highway, but now it's even more than that.
Oh, it absolutely is. I think it gives us a historical perspective of what, in this example, of what the highways did to this country, for good and for bad. I mean, this created a situation where every homeowner had to move, and there was areas in here that were primarily black, so they had to move somewhere. They went into the city of Lansing, so it helped segregate Lansing, but also at the same time, it created some white flight. So it's an interesting dynamic that you can start thinking about. This is more than a photograph.
Right.
It's a very important piece of history.
Right. This is Peter Worf with Bill Castanier for Current State. We're at the photography exhibit called Sepia to Selfies, and we're looking at some of the different sections. I love this daredevil section, Bill, with Arsenault Seldon. Let's see, what was his nickname again?
Stratosphere Man.
Stratosphere Man. We did a story on him a few months ago.
Amazing.
And then you have the Batman and this incredible photograph here of Ethel Dare. Who is she?
That's something we did not know.
Yeah.
A local collector said, well, if you're going to do daredevils, you've got to include Ethel Dare. She was born in Lansing, Michigan. She was one of the first wing walkers. She was the first woman to go from plane to plane in the air.
Here she is standing on top of the wing of, I think that might be a Curtis Jenny.
It is.
And then another one above it. She's holding on to... kind of a handrail, but it's really just a wire, really, between two struts on top of one wing. And she's going to jump up and grab that other plane.
Up and climb on the other plane.
And I think she has no parachute.
No, she did not have a parachute. She also did
it's unbelievable.
She did a trick where she held a rope in her mouth and dangled and fell. She pretended to fall, but caught herself with a rope in her mouth. But we had to show these. Yeah. Because one of the things we wanted to do is try to show things that people hadn't seen or would be surprised to see. I had never seen a photograph of Ethel Dare, never even knew who she was. Those are just a little slice of Lansing, I think, that people may have forgotten about, and we wanted to put it in one place. Like over here, we did parades. And we included a variety of kind of parades. Several of these photographs are by a woman named Clara Heldemeyer, who was a very, very high-level amateur photographer in Lansing from about 1910 to 1940 to 50. And we discovered her photo books, photo albums, and her scrapbooks.
She was really recognized for her work, too.
She sure was. In 1939, she exhibited at the World's Fair in New York City at the Kodak Pavilion. And she was quite, quite competent. And you can just see, she had an unusual eye. She took some photographs of parades, for example, that show not the whole zebra, but parts of the zebra. That was intent. I mean, she had some intent with her photography. She knew composition. So what we did is we combined a variety of different parades, like a local Red Cross girls with the Knights Templar, but also something very different would be the KKK
right.
rally and parade.
There's another one of a KKK rally just around the corner here that when I saw it, I was really startled by this one.
And that's why we included it. We had some debate whether this should be included.
Right. Burning crosses, burning letters that say KKK 100%.
Exactly, and it was shot for sure in Lansing because right under the stage are advertisements from Lansing companies. One of the reasons we wanted to show it in this exhibit, this area of the exhibit about news photography is it was photographs like this that often changed the world we live in. I think when people saw photographs like this, they understood this wasn't a fun club. The photograph is very damaged. From what we understand, it is the only known existing photograph of that event. The others were destroyed, or they got lost, or whatever. It was taken by Leavenworth Photography of Lansing.
This is it here. This print is the only one.
This is the only print, 1924. It's startling, I think. If someone hasn't seen one of those, it startles people. Most of the people, the backs are turned to them, but if you look closely, there's one woman very close to where the Klan are that's turned around. You can see her face.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, there's the hooded and robed Klansmen in front of the burning crosses, and many of them standing underneath, too. And a lot of people are there, too.
Very, very much so. And the next day, there was a parade of 15,000 Klansmen in Lansing. That cold hand's taken
hold of me. Bill, we're trying to cover as much as we can, so we're looking at some select areas. I loved some of these photos in an area that's sort of, I guess, informally titled Dance Dance.
Right, and this is another group of photography, or photographs that we sort of did. People knew they were out there, but we didn't, and David Olds and his spouse, Marcia. Marcia owns what is formerly the Virgiline Simmons Dance Studio. Well, when she bought that dance studio, she got hundreds of photographs with it that go back to the 1920s. We have a selection of maybe just a dozen of them. They are absolutely phenomenal, showing little kids dancing. They show Virgiline dancing.
Which one's Virgiline?
Virgiline is the 1920s kind of flapper look up here.
Oh, yeah.
Very cool photograph.
Sure, she's got the bob and the short dress and everything.
And you can date it by that. And sure. Then up in the left corner, of course, are the four Morlock quads, which were world famous. Down, okay, here's a photograph. I knew the woman down here. It's Annette Abrams. She's doing a handstand. She was the first African-American in the Miss Michigan contest.
Oh.
She was from Lansing, Michigan, and she was Miss Lansing. And I saw that, I thought, to me, because she died about 10 years ago, and I thought, wow, that's got to be Annette, and it was.
I love this one of these eight girls who are sort of dressed up like costumes. They look sort of like flowers or plants. I can't really tell.
I can't either. And what's interesting is David told me that not only do they have the photographs, they have the sketches of the costumes. And I think David's thinking about, as he saw these exhibited, about doing a book based on these, and I think it would be a phenomenal. It's a slice of time.
It is.
You'll never see again.
Bill Castanier is curator of From Sepia to Selfies here at the Library of Michigan. Bill, thanks for the tour today.
Thank you very much for coming.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And coming up on Current State, basic needs like employment and housing can be a struggle for people who've served time in prison. This weekend in Jackson, former prison inmates will meet with concerned citizens and others to discuss reforms to America's prison system. Current State's Scott Pohl has more. Plus, we hear from the music director of the New York Philharmonic, who is in Ann Arbor this week, Maestro Alan Gilbert. Our Jamie Paisley speaks with Maestro Gilbert. That and more coming up after the break. Current State on 90.5 WKAR, also every weekday at noon on AM 870. We're always online at WKAR.org. The U.S. Department of Justice has announced the early release of 6,000 prison inmates who have served lengthy sentences for drug crimes. What will become of them once they're out a few weeks from now? Well, a program in Jackson on Saturday may hint at what awaits them when they're freed. Current State Scott Pohl is here with more. Tell us about Bridges to Justice this weekend, Scott.
Well, Mark, you know, prison has been a part of Jackson's story since the Michigan State Prison opened there in 1839. On Saturday, the Jackson Area Civil Rights Awareness Association will conduct workshops on parole readiness and advocating for legislative action. Former inmates will be there to talk about their experiences both in and out of prison. I talked with the association's Christine Peterson and also with Hakeem Crampton, who spent time in prison in Wisconsin.
At the age of 12 years old, a juvenile, I got arrested for an assault at school. That led to me being into the juvenile system. I did juvenile time, put on probation, violated the probation, got locked back up, got out, violated the probation, got locked back up. This continued on until I became an adult. And once I became an adult, I was essentially doomed to the system. By the time I was 18, I was arrested in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for a homicide charge that I had absolutely no involvement in. But because I had a criminal record, because it was something I was likely to be involved in, the Milwaukee Police Department decided to do a probe to see if we knew anything about the murder that happened in our neighborhood. So they began to play an interrogation game, accusing myself of confessing to the crime to others. They then told me that others that had been arrested with me also confessed to the crime, whereas none of us really confessed to the crime at all until enough of this had taken place over a 6-7 day period in which a gentleman by the name of Mark Henry believed that I confessed to the crime, and he ultimately confessed and pled guilty and testified against myself and my co-defendant Joe Robinson, and we were stuck in prison. A place where I was likely to be at anyway. It just so happened that I happened to be in prison for a crime I didn't commit, which there's thousands and thousands of people in prison for crimes they didn't commit every day.
And this was in the state of Wisconsin?
It's in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 1991. I was arrested November 6th of 1991.
How much time did you do?
I did 15 years. I was sentenced to 45 years. I was found guilty of first-degree reckless homicide. Sentenced to 45 years. It took me a long time to gain the type of support I needed to get from the legal community to fight on my behalf. And Reuben Hurricane Carter, recently deceased, fought for his own innocence, won his release, became a champion of innocent people like myself. His organization heard of my case, picked my case up, handed it over to the Wisconsin Innocence Project under Keith Finley, and they took it and took it to the Wisconsin parole chairman. And said, hey, you know, we know you're not the courts. We know you can't overturn this man's conviction, but you do have someone in your system that is innocent, and we'd like you to consider parole. And that's what he did. He considered parole and let me out after 15 years.
So it was a matter of parole as opposed to exoneration.
Absolutely.
Correct. And when was this?
This was in 2006.
What did you do after that?
Immediately, I went to the schools. I went to the juvenile homes and began sharing my story, sharing with kids about what had happened to me, the fact that not only could something what happened to me happen to you, but aside from me being innocent, just the normal facets of life that affected me could happen to them as well. And they could find themselves in the system, whether guilty or not guilty.
And you moved back to Jackson when?
Yeah, I came back to Jackson immediately. The upon my release, I came straight back to Jackson, right on the highway, straight from Wisconsin prison, right to Jackson, Michigan.
So is this a living for you now?
Absolutely, it is. It is. I make a living telling my story to essentially. I go around. I've been around the country. I've been on several different tours. I do spoken word poetry, and I share my story through poetry, through my pain and through my suffering. I share that openly in poetry about what happened to me legally.
We're talking with Christine Peterson of the Jackson Area Civil Rights Awareness Association and Hakeem Crampton. On Saturday, October 10th, they'll be hosting a program called Bridges to Justice, Mass Incarceration Causes, Costs, and Reforms in Jackson. Hakeem, you've been involved in both the juvenile system and the adult system then. Did the juvenile system fail you, would you say?
Absolutely.
Or did you fail it?
It's a double-edged sword. It's definitely a dichotomy. The juvenile system did not have sufficient programming in place for an individual like myself and like many of the children that are in the system now. The system applies programming that is not geared specifically, culturally, and relevantly to the lives of the young people that are affected by a crime that brought them into contact with juvenile custody. And so their treatment methods are really academically inspired. They're logistical and they're not practical. And so from that point of view, the juvenile justice system did fail me. It essentially warehoused me. There was never a moment when I was pulled out of my room and said, hey, you know, do you know what you did? Let's process this together and figure out where your life's going to go. That never happened.
What would you change about the juvenile system and the adult system? If you had the ear of Governor Snyder today, mm-hmm. what would you say should be changed?
What should be changed first and foremost is this. The system has to begin listening to people that's been in the system, that have survived the system. People like myself, I consider myself to be a person with a remedy to the crisis of incarceration, to the crisis of criminality. I consider myself to be a solution to that. And it's going to take the governor, this state, to listen to people like myself that spent years in prison studying books, basically taking a crash course doctorate's degree, and you know, without the paper, without the degree, essentially. And we've learned a lot of information, and we're capable of applying that information in a powerful way if we're given that chance. And instead, we're given that box of a felon, and we're not even able to be employed when we get out, let alone apply some of these remedies and solutions to the crisis of incarceration.
Christine Peterson, how typical would you say Hakeem's story is?
We hear a lot of these stories, and in fact, that's what got us involved in this project, is because the Jackson Civil Rights Awareness Association meets weekly to talk about civil rights issues, and we've had felons, returned citizens, come to our group and tell their stories, and that's what hooked us.
You just used the phrase returned citizen. I promised you that we would bring that up. That's an alternative as opposed to, say, parolee or former prisoner, former inmate sorts of language. Can you explain why you think returned citizen is a phrase that the rest of us should start getting used to using?
I use it because I was told that was a respectful term. To me, it's returned citizens, you're citizens. And you're returning to us, and it's our obligation as a community to make that a welcome and to help you reintegrate into the community that you want to live and work in. Most of the felons, the returned citizens that we've come in contact with, are serving the community, but they're blocked out of the schools, for example, because there's a rule that you can't have a felony and work with kids. But these people are going to the streets and working with kids where the kids are. And they're doing amazing things. And we just celebrate these lives that have reconstructed themselves with very little help, and we want to change that.
You must encounter returned citizens who have not had as much success as Hakeem has had at forging a living in the years after prison. Can you explain to me some of the particular problems people like that encounter, and and what sorts of solutions to those problems you might suggest?
Hakeem is making a living in this service as a sense that that's the spirit of his life. He's not making a financial living.
There are so many barriers, for one, for being a convicted felon. You're barred from housing, you're barred from employment, and there's other discriminatory social practices that take place just by being a felon. And for me, what allowed me to have a measure of transitional success is the fact that I planned and prepared for my release. One of the things that doesn't take place in prisons is prisoners aren't properly prepared and educated for their release. That usually takes place at the end of a person's incarceration. Prior to them just getting released, the system says, well, you're about to get released, we're going to transition you. That, to me, is a fundamental failure, because you need to begin starting the process of transition the moment you walk in the door. I don't care if you're sentenced to 50 years in prison. If you're going to get out in 30 years, then you need to begin that process now, because it takes place within, not just academically on a paper where you prepare and plan.
Christine, I wanted to ask you about bringing in people to programs like this one coming up in Jackson who have never met someone who was in prison, has no idea how to deal with them, maybe is afraid of them. What's your message to people who might have an interest in dipping their toe into these waters?
One of the things we're going to do during registration is having some returned citizens mill around and welcome people. We have a table that they're going to man that will tell their stories. And at lunch, we're going to, Teaching Tolerance has this mix it up at lunch. We're going to mix it up at lunch and give people table assignments. So there's a returned citizen at each table, and we're going to have some conversation cards so people can engage in conversations. We did a project I called 10-10 because we had 10 felons and 10 middle-class church people. And spent the day together having these conversations, and it was very successful in terms of people had built relationships and still have them today and still talk to each other. That's the most important thing.
Hakeem Crampton of Jackson, I want to thank you for sharing your story with us. Good luck.
Thank you.
We've also been talking with Christine Peterson of the Jackson Area Civil Rights Awareness Association. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
On Saturday, October 10th, they'll be running a program called Bridges to Justice, Mass Incarceration Causes, Costs, and Reforms at St. John's UCC Church on South Mechanic Street in Jackson from 9 to 3 p.m. For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl. For sinking me in debt, I can't fault their mighty muscles for the pounding in my chest. Deep in uncharted waters with a rock upon my neck, I've taken every paradox and I put it to the test. Yes, see, they framed Picasso for looking past the lines, and I wonder if his alibi was opium or wine. I know it's been the downfall of many other men, but don't blame it on the whiskey, 'cause the whiskey's still my friend. Don't blame it on the whiskey. Don't blame it on the whiskey. I know it's been a burden.
That's Rob Clyda, formerly of The Lash, singing Don't Blame It on the Whiskey here in Studio S on a Live Music Friday. Tomorrow, Current State returns with Live Music Friday, and we welcome Grammy Award-winning jazz trumpeter Brian Lynch, along with MSU Jazz faculty members Rodney Whitaker, Etienne Charles, Xavier Davis, and Randy Gillespie. We hope you can join us. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last night, he conducted the New York Philharmonic in Carnegie Hall. And tonight, he'll be bringing that fantastic orchestra to Ann Arbor. Maestro Alan Gilbert and the New York Phil is about to begin a multi-year residency with the University of Michigan's Fine Arts Branch, the University Musical Society. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with Maestro Gilbert earlier this week about his Michigan trip, which I understand will also include one of the largest live audiences he's ever had. Is that right, Jamie?
Oh, that's fair to say, Mark. Maestro Gilbert will be leading the U of M marching band, as well as the New York Philharmonic Brass Section, and others as part of the halftime performance of the Michigan Northwestern game, which is to say that he'll be conducting for an audience of about 110,000 people.
I can't wait. I'm not going to lie to you. This is really the highlight for me to play at the halftime of the game with you know, our brass musicians, but also the marching bands of U of M. It's totally cool, and it's something that obviously I don't get the chance to do very often. I'm supposed to stand on the ladder, and somehow, with the help of two adjunct conductors, or I'm not exactly sure what the arrangement will be. I guess they will be sort of in different places so more musicians can see what's happening. But yeah, I'll actually be conducting. And yeah, this is a big debut for me.
a giant debut.
Huge. Unbelievable. I think they said there were going to be 1,000 performers or something like that. Something absurd. Now's the time to do Mahler 8th Symphony.
Instead of Mahler's Symphony for 1,000, the New York Philharmonic will kick off their 3-day residency with a much smaller setting. Several U of M students went to New York to work with selected Philharmonic members to prep for a chamber music concert featuring Mendelssohn's Octet and Mozart's Serenade for Winds in the Rackham Auditorium in Ann Arbor for this side-by-side concert tonight. Maestro Gilbert will also be there at 6 p.m. to deliver a keynote address called Orchestras in the 21st Century, A New Paradigm.
It will be based on a lecture I gave in London last spring. It's a very broad topic, but specifically I'm interested in how orchestras have changed the brief, essentially, what orchestras are about. Obviously, we still play concerts. We still bring people into the concert hall for a musical experience that is live and hopefully visceral and exciting and moving and profound and all that. But orchestras these days are being asked to do so much more, and the partnership with the University of Michigan is a perfect example of this kind of reaching out and actually having residencies and engaging in education and doing things that the traditional symphony orchestra didn't do.
Then tomorrow, Friday, the main New York Philharmonic residency concerts move to the Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor. And when I spoke to Maestro Gilbert on Monday, he discussed the concert opener, which he only just premiered last night in Carnegie Hall. Vivo by Magnus Lindberg.
Obviously, we haven't done it before. We're about to play it for the first time in Carnegie on Wednesday, but then we're right away turning around and playing it in Ann Arbor. His music is colorful. People have described it as technicolor. I actually find that there is a very human experience. One of the things that he likes to play with is tempo, and when different sections of music bleed from one into the next, it's sort of like shifting gears. The car kind of goes at the same speed, but you shift gears and there's either a higher rev on the engine or a lower rev. So as the sections shift, there's almost always a connecting thread rhythmically, which makes it kind of fun to listen to. It's as if you're being sort of driven along at different speeds and seeing different aspects of scenery, but at the same time you're always in the same car, if you see what I mean.
Following this second ever performance of that Magnus Lindberg work is a couple of pieces by Beethoven, including a symphony with a rather famous allegretto.
Beethoven is about many things. He's actually about everything. His music really is about life. But the Seventh Symphony definitely highlights rhythm, and it was famously described as the apotheosis of the dance. It's constantly moving, and it's certainly one of the most exciting pieces. The movement you refer to does feel a little bit like a funeral march, but it's not a slow movement, and it has a kind of propulsion, even though it's reflective and deeply moving.
Joining Maestro Alan Gilbert and the New York Philharmonic on Friday night in Ann Arbor is their first ever Artist in Association, pianist Enon Barnaton, for Beethoven's first piano concerto. So then, what is the difference between the new Artist in Association and the more common Artist in Residence?
Yeah, it's a fair question. You know, it's a kind of awkward title. We wanted to differentiate that position to our Artist in Residence. The Artist in Association position was created to give a younger artist the possibility of having an association with the orchestra over a period of years. You know, for young artists making a debut, obviously there's a certain amount of pressure, but one of the things that is of great concern is the re-invitation. And we wanted to take that out of the equation. So we committed to 3 years in a row, a number of engagements, different concertos over a 3-year span, and someone cooked up the title Artisan Association to reflect that.
And after Friday's opening night concert featuring the Artisan Association Enon Barnaton, Saturday's concert highlights their new composer in residence.
Yeah, Esa Pekka Salonen is our new composer in residence, and he's very well known as a composer, but perhaps many people have first heard of him as a conductor. He's a wonderful, magnificent conductor, definitely one of the beloved guests at New York Philharmonic. And LA Variations represents this kind of liberation that he experienced as a composer. He was living and working in LA, where he was music director of the LA Philharmonic. And he described the experience of waking up one day and just realizing that it's okay to follow his heart and write a piece that is lush and rich and happy and represents some of the spirit, I think, that he enjoyed in LA.
Paired with Saturday's L.A. Variations by Esa-Pekka Salonen is a major work by Richard Strauss, Ein Heldenleben, A Hero's Life.
The name is not without a certain kind of hubris, a heroic life, talking about himself, obviously. But it's a beautiful piece, and it really does tell the story of his life, both personally in terms of his relationship with his wife and family, but also his compositional creative life.
For Sunday's final concert during this first session of University Musical Society residency at the University of Michigan, well, the New York Philharmonic's music director, Alan Gilbert, will be stepping down from the podium and giving it to conductor and film composer David Newman for a special live orchestral accompaniment to the Marlon Brando On the Waterfront, which features the only film score composed by former New York Philharmonic music director, Leonard Bernstein.
It's really exciting because in so many films, the music is an absolutely integral part. It's possible to almost go through a film without really consciously registering the music. Obviously, it plays a huge part in affecting the emotional journey you take while watching the film. But when it's a soundtrack, it's kind of there and you experience it and hopefully it's a powerful emotional journey. But when you have the orchestra actually sitting on stage playing it, you can't miss it. And actually it highlights the music in a way that is very immediate, very visceral. And people have just loved the movies that we've accompanied the live orchestra. And it's really nice that we're able to bring this to our residency in Ann Arbor.
Now, during Saturday's halftime appearance at the University of Michigan Northwestern game, Maestro Gilbert will surely be conducting The Victors, but will that famed University of Michigan fight song also make it to the concert hall in Hill Auditorium?
Well, we have a little surprise on our concert plan, but I shouldn't talk about it.
You can find out more about the New York Philharmonic at nyphil.org and also more details about their residency in Ann Arbor this weekend at ums.org. Maestro Alan Gilbert, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Finally today, we leave you with a glimpse of the past and a hope for the future. When the Michigan State Medical Society moved into its East Lansing headquarters back in 1959, a letter was buried into the cornerstone of the building. It was written by Dr. Gordon H. Scott, who was then the dean of the Wayne State University Medical School. Yesterday, in honor of the Society's 150th anniversary, that letter was opened. Current State was there to hear past Society President Dr. James Grant read aloud a prediction for medicine in the 21st century.
To whom it may concern, in the year 2000, the medical profession will be doing what they have done since the beginnings of time. They will still be attempting, with no success whatever, to divorce themselves from every important social change. They will continue to deny that the problems they create should claim their attention in the future. In 2000 AD, society will be told that it must provide the answers to overpopulation, the aging population, the senseless prolonging of human misery, and every genetic ill that interference with natural selection can bring. The doctor's role as the pampered darling of civilization will not have been relinquished. He said it, not me. Doctors will still need to have this strutting upon the stage, applauded constantly by their value recognized not only in respect, but in things which surround them. Physicians will still be physicians in 2000 AD and will be a vital element of living that we can almost afford. Gordon H. Scott, PhD, Dean.
When Dr. Grant finished reading the letter from 1959, the incoming Medical Society president, Dr. David Krovsky, stepped forward with a set of predictions that won't be read again until the year 2065.
So here's just a few of the predictions. Technology will change healthcare dramatically, including the creation of cellular-based imaging. Malignant diseases such as cancer, as well as chronic deteriorating diseases like diabetes, arthritis, asthma, and the like, will disappear. Identification devices will be implanted at birth. We'll see genetic manipulation. We'll see universal healthcare. Preterm birth will have been eradicated, and new categories of care professionals will emerge, including preventionists. It'll be very interesting 50 years from now when those who come after us open this time capsule and see how close we were to the mark.
Doctors James Grant and David Krovsky of the Michigan State Medical Society there reading a letter from 1959 and sealing a new writing that will be opened in another 50 years. We're back tomorrow with Current State. It's a live music Friday. We hope you can join us then. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day.